And I got back into reading a book a month last year, and so I've tried to share my book reviews with everybody here on the program. And so far, so good. I'm 3 for 3 here in 2025. And my March book that I'm going to review now is a very controversial book. I heard Dan McDowell review this book 4 years ago when it came out here on the station, and it sounded like a very interesting book that I wanted to read, but I have not gotten around to reading it until now. And it's a very controversial book here in the state of Texas. The title, Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. It's a New York Times bestseller written by Brian Burrow, Chris Tomlinson, and Jason Stanford. I believe two of the three are Austin-based writers, and the third has some ties to Texas. But the three collaborated on this book, Forget the Alamo.
We can't. We can't in this state.
No, we can't. This is a fascinating book. The first half of it deals with the history of the Alamo, the Texas Revolution or Revolt, whatever you want to call it. The second half of the book deals with the Alamo and how people have tried to keep it alive or bury it. Even gets into the Phil Collins collection, which we'll talk about here in a minute.
So weird.
But growing up in the state of Oklahoma, even though I'm a native Texan, I grew up, my formative years were in Oklahoma, so I got Oklahoma history. I didn't take Texas history, so when I moved back to Texas my junior year in high school, I didn't have to take Texas history, so I never really heard the full details of the Alamo, just superficially. What I had heard about it, I always wondered why it was so revered, because from my limited knowledge about the Alamo, we kind of got our asses kicked there. It was a slaughter.
Yeah.
And so I wondered why it was so revered, because before I learned a little bit about it, I thought that the Texas forces won the Battle of the Alamo.
So let's say this. They held them off they lost in the fourth quarter, but they were playing a much larger opponent, and they hung in there for a long time. How about that?
Yeah, a much larger opponent. So I never really knew the details behind the story until I read this book. So when Mexico gained independence from Spain, this is early 1800s, they took control of the territory known as Texas. The Mexican government wanted to entice colonists to move here, so they enlisted the help of some, as they were called at the time, Texians, to get people to come here and settle. But making money and making a life in Texas in the early 1800s was tough going. You had Native American tribes that were very hostile to settlers. Farming was tough. Livestock was tough. Everything was tough. It was an incredibly violent place, and nobody wanted to come here. Well, one of the empresarios, as they were called, working for the Mexican government to try to lure people to come to Texas, was Stephen F. Austin, very famous name in this state. The only way, though, to make money here at the time were the cotton farms, the cotton plantations, the fertile soil of southeast Texas, which required allowing people coming from different states, different parts of the country, to employ slavery. Mexico, which ruled Texas, was anti-slavery, an abolitionist government, after years of the Mexican people working as Spanish slaves under Spanish rule.
Yeah.
So they knew it was morally wrong. They were very anti-slavery, but Stephen F. Austin lobbied hard for it, and Santa Anna, who was running Mexico at the time, basically, initially gave Stephen F. Austin everything he wanted, with some rules against slave trading. Eventually, in 1828, the Mexican government passed sweeping anti-slavery laws, which the Texans ignored. Meanwhile, cotton is booming in Texas, and the seeds of the revolt were planted. But what I never knew, and I guess it's a lot like the Civil War, at the heart of it was slavery.
Yeah.
At the heart of the Texas revolt was the right to keep slavery. And Stephen F. Austin, in fact, in 1832 wrote, quote, Texas must be a slave country. And that's what motivated the Texas War against Mexico, the War for Independence, because it was the only thing that was making any kind of money here, and it was the only way to attract people to move here.
And the narrative that I think has been taught traditionally, at least the way I remember it, and as a kid, I was one of those who was fascinated with the Alamo. It was about freedom,
right?
Ironically. It was about freedom from, you know, the Mexican government. But, yeah, that was not discussed.
Freedom for everybody except the enslaved.
Except the slave. The slavery was not talked about that I remember.
Right. So Texas started fighting back, and a lot of little skirmishes were breaking out. Violence was breaking out. Lots of rumors of larger attacks and things like that. And in this book, this kind of put it into perspective for me. There's a passage that says the Americans had ignored the Mexican laws, evaded taxes, and when the Mexican government insists that they actually pay them, they attacked and killed Mexican soldiers. So imagine, they say, if the United States opens interior Alaska to colonization today, and for whatever reason, thousands of Canadians pour in and establish their own farms, hockey rinks, and Tim Horton stores. When we insist they follow American laws and pay American taxes because it's American soil, they refuse. When we try to enforce the laws, they shoot and kill American soldiers. When we insist on arresting the murderers, the Canadians take up arms in open revolt. How would we all feel?
Yeah.
Well, that's how Santa Ana felt.
Yeah.
That's how the Mexican government felt. They said, wait, this is our property. We're letting them on here.
We encourage you to come here. Yeah.
And they're not abiding by our laws.
Yeah.
So those were the seeds of the battle. And then it gets into the actual battle, and details are very, very sketchy because there were very few survivors on the American side, the Texian side. It was a slaughter. It was a military disaster because everybody could see what was coming even before Santa Ana's troops arrived in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And they should have abandoned the mission. There was a 0% chance of success. Help was not coming, and they were just sitting ducks. There was no way to fight an army that was 6 to 8 times the size of the troops that were in the Alamo. And a lot of those troops were volunteers that didn't really have much of a vested interest, but they didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
Talks a lot about the big three: William Travis, Jim Bowie, and Davy Crockett. Those are the three biggest names, the Holy Trinity of the Alamo, and how their lives were and how they died, because there are lots of different stories around the deaths of those three. They were all pretty wheels off. Now, this book describes them as incredibly wheels off people. Alcoholics, slave traders, slave owners, legacies that were outsized to what they actually did, con men. And I think a lot of that was true. But I also, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking pretty much everybody in the early 1800s in Texas was tremendously wheels off. That does not excuse slave trading or slave owning or anything like that. But pretty much everybody was an alcoholic or a con man.
Yeah, I mean, it was the time.
Yes.
You know, it was rough times.
Very rough times. So while I think these stories sound mostly true about those three, that's probably everybody in Western expansion America in the early 1800s.
Yeah. I mean, that was our country then.
The way the three died, and by the way, Travis never drew a line in the sand. There was no corroboration of that story whatsoever. They all didn't fight to the death. Several surrendered and then were executed, including Davy Crockett. The popular story is that Crockett fought to the death. You know, he was gunning them all down as they came to get him, but he actually was one of those who surrendered, according to most of the available evidence.
That's the way the most recent Alamo movie depicted it.
Had him surrender.
At least he survived, and then they killed him at the end.
Yeah. Travis, they said, was a pretty good leader, but immediately when the battle started, he took a bullet to the forehead and dropped, and that was it for Travis. But they say that the men did rally around him, and he was a pretty good leader. He was just, there was no way they were going to win it. Jim Bowie was in bed, sick as a dog.
And that's been consistent throughout.
Yeah.
That was even in the first movie back in the 50s and always talked about. Yeah.
Never even took part in the fight, and they say he probably, you know, they soldiers burst in and probably shot him in his sick bed.
Yeah.
So it was a military disaster, but the battle after that, they even go into some details about the Battle of San Jacinto. That was a military masterclass by Sam Houston.
Yeah.
And so they made up for the disaster at the Alamo with the Battle of San Jacinto.
And the way I remember it, Sam Houston was pleading with those guys to get out of there.
Yes.
And to join him and
to get out of the Alamo.
Yeah, to get out of the Alamo and, you know, join him and let's make this a fair fight at some point.
So those are the details. Again, they go way more into detail than I'm able to do here in 10 minutes on the details of the Alamo and what led up to it and what happened afterwards. The part of the book about the fight to preserve the Alamo, I lost a little interest, to be honest with you. The original battle between the two women that were really passionate about the Alamo in San Antonio, including Clara Driscoll, famous name here in Texas, that was kind of interesting. But then it got real political about what to do with the Alamo and all the San Antonio government infighting, and the book lost me a little bit there. But it got me back when they got into the Phil Collins collection. So the former frontman for Genesis, very famous rock and roll star, somehow he's British, and he got into the Alamo.
Crazy.
And he started collecting, at first, little things, and then he got so into the Alamo that he started collecting anything and everything. And he had a couple of guys working for him in the United States that if something would pop up, they'd say, hey, we got Jim Bowie's underwear. We got William Travis's right shoe, something like that. Even without provenance, Phil Collins would buy it, and he'd pay millions of dollars for it.
So he has hundreds of artifacts?
Hundreds.
Wow.
Yet, the controversy is that only a few of them are believable.
Oh, no.
And he came to this agreement with the city of San Antonio. I think they're finally building this museum, an Alamo museum. They really haven't kept care of the Alamo for years and years and years in San Antonio. You know, when we would visit it, there's a Dunkin' Donuts, like, almost in it, and it's a carnival atmosphere down there, and they don't do a very good job of keeping it up or recognizing it. Well, they're trying to change that in San Antonio, and they're trying to build this museum, and they want Phil Collins' collection to be a centerpiece. But now the controversy is that nobody believes much of what he has in his collection is the real thing.
Oh, man.
And this book, the authors tried to get a hold of him several times, and he gets really pissed when anybody brings up that he may have a bunch of phony stuff in his Alamo collection. Oh. But they say it's very, very, very hard to verify a lot of that stuff from that era.
He doesn't have like a 1836 Dunkin' Donuts hat, does he?
No. That's kind of believable, though. But, for example, they dug up some horseshoes on the Alamo grounds. I don't know when this was, 20 or 30 years ago. And someone just told Phil Collins, these are the horseshoes from the horses from Santa Ana's troops.
Okay.
And he believed it and bought all of them. Well, but then it came out that there was a horse stable that was erected on those grounds 50 years after the Battle of the Alamo, and that it's very likely those horseshoes are from that stable.
I thought you were going to say they had a horseshoe competition there and guys were throwing right. shoes.
But Phil Collins is just paying millions for these without verification, and so they don't even know if they want to put his collection in the Alamo Museum because it's so dubious.
Wow.
So I don't know where that stands.
That's how legends go, though, right? I mean, we just we kind of almost make up our own narrative after a while about what it represents and what it means.
Yeah, and a lot of the legend was created or rewritten by Hollywood, the John Wayne movie. And there were a lot of big events in pop culture or in Hollywood that kind of rewrote the Alamo narrative. And that's what ended up being taught to a lot of people in Texas history. So it's an interesting book. It's called Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. It's not a popular book in Texas, but it's an interesting book for sure.